Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, our guests ask you, and he has seen this, so it's not in his imagination. Imagine living in a place where you can kill anyone you wish and nothing happens except that they fall dead. You will not be arrested. Your name will not be in the newspapers. You can continue on with your life and your killing. You can take a woman and rape her for days and nothing will happen. If you choose, if in some way that woman displeases you, well, you can kill her after raping her. Rest assured, nothing will happen to you because of your actions. We're going to talk about a number of issues. It is the murder capital of the world. Murder City is the name of Charles Bowden's book, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. He talks about Juarez long supplying Americans with what they wanted, booze, women, opiates, quick divorces. And the city has operated as a partnership between criminal organizations and government. It is a hellhole from all indications in this book, which is a very disturbing, extremely well-written account of what's been going on in Juarez. Our guest, Charles, has been examining this situation for quite some time. He is the critically acclaimed author of many books, including Down by the River, A Shadow in the City, and Some of the Dead Are Still Breathing. He's a contributing editor for GQ and Mother Jones, and also writes for Harper's Magazine, The New York Times, Book Review, Aperture, and other places, and he is with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. I think we'll have a lot of calls on this because he weaves in the drug war and how the money is huge and probably quite misguided. He talks about education. He talks about NAFTA. So I think that as we speak here, your calls will be coming in. So here's the number, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hello, Charles.
Well, howdy. Glad to be here.
Yeah, very nice to have you here. You end the book with, I think you've probably finished reading this book right now, but you were reading Eric Severide's memoirs of covering World War II and this death thing that happens. I don't know how you could witness and what you did and not just sort of become numb by all of this. I guess you have to walk away when you become numb, or you couldn't keep this on this kind of reporting. But this story just is unbelievable, Charles.
Except it's true.
Yeah.
No, I understand the feeling. I also understand the numbness that, you know, I have to ration Juarez now after the book. Not because it's dangerous, but because I can't bear to look at it anymore for a while.
Really? So it has to stay out of your system for a while?
Well, I try to keep it that way, but Juarez is a type of circumstance where once you know about it, it's hard to turn your back on it. You can't pretend it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they've killed over 900 people since the first of this year.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, in fact, there's 11,000 Mexican soldiers and federal police there now. And all that's accomplished is the murder rate. The killings get larger and larger. There was a day, a week or so ago, where they killed 22 people in one day.
Oh, my goodness.
So the interest I have in the city is I think it suggests something about the future. Because the bottom line in Juarez is poverty. And the bottom line of the poverty is it's a laboratory almost for notions of free trade.
Mm-hmm.
It has over 400 foreign factories.
400?
Over 400. Like Electrolux vacuum cleaners are made in Juarez.
I mean,
you go to a store and you're seeing things made in Juarez. So you're dealing with a city that's supposed to be the future. And I guess it is. But the future is the people in these factories get paid slave wages. Turnover is 100 to 200% a year in these foreign-owned factories, mainly U.S. Kids are raised in a feral atmosphere. 50% of the adolescents neither have a job nor are in school. There's 500 to 900 street gangs. And I could go on and on. Then you overlay this with a thriving drug industry, and you get an explosion.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening in Juarez. It's now, I think without question, the most violent city in the world, far more violent, let us say, than Baghdad.
Mm-hmm. And the people who are killed just sort of go unnoticed, which is pretty alarming descriptions in your book, because they are, quote, supposedly not good people, but the truth is they're just regular people, many of them.
That's correct. I mean, there's a magical thing. The real magical realism isn't in Latin American literature. It's in the war, the violence going on in Mexico. You're an ordinary citizen until you're murdered, and once you're murdered, then you're declared to somehow be in the drug industry.
Mm.
Well, this is nonsense. The president of Mexico says 90% of the dead in this war, and I should tell your listeners, since January 1st, 2007, 24,000 Mexicans have been slaughtered in this violence. Once you're dead, 90% of them, he says, are dirty, you know, connected to drugs. Well, that's just a lie. But the other thing you have to realize is the city has 100, there's a million people. It's got 150 to 200,000 addicts.
Ugh.
Drugs are everywhere. I'll make it simple. To survive there, a lot of people are living off drug money one way or another because there's no other way to survive.
And the Mexican economy is living off drug money.
Well, that's the dirty little secret that's never admitted by our government. But Pemex, their oil industry, is considered officially as their leading source of foreign exchange currency. Second comes remittances, meaning Mexicans illegally working in the United States sending money home. That's $20 to $25 billion. But the drug industry earns $30 to $50 billion. It's, if you remove the drug income from Mexico, the country would collapse. And we know that, and they know that, and we both lie about it.
So who's getting that money, Charles?
Well, various people. You know, you have to spread it around. There's 3,500 police forces. They're all bought and corrupted. The army certainly gets their share. And, of course, all Mexican politicians, or a lot of them, live off drug money. And then, of course, the people in the industry, the workers and the owners of the drug products, get their money. It's disseminated all over the country. But to make it simple, American drug consumption ships $30 to $50 billion a year to Mexico, and it's distributed to murderers.
Mm-hmm.
That's who the industry is. It's because it's illegal, the drug industry can't function without killing. You can't go to court because somebody didn't fulfill a contract. You have to kill them to get discipline.
Mm.
But that's always been true of the drug industry. Look, the drug industry has always been lethal. You know, it's been gangs competing with other gangs. Juarez has always been a center of the drug industry for decades. But Juarez never got past 300 murders a year until President Calderon unleashed the Mexican army in this initiative. Now, let me see, in 2008, there were 1,600 murders. In 2009, there were 2,753 murders. And this year, there's been over 900 murders. You know, I lose track.
Oh.
25% of the houses have been abandoned. 40% of the businesses have closed. You know, on and on. The city's dying.
And so people are coming to the United States?
The rich. Well, there's two groups. 30 to 60,000 more affluent Mexicans from the Juarez area have moved over to El Paso because they have the papers, you know.
Right.
And so they cross, buy a house, and just blend into the population. The poor are trapped like rats in Juarez. They just get murdered. Their only exodus is they can take a bus and go into the interior, which some have done, but there's no work in Mexico. NAFTA was passed, and essentially it was implemented in 1994, the North American Free Trade Treaty. And if you look at the Border Patrol apprehension statistics, within 18 months of the passage of NAFTA, there's an explosion of migrants coming into the United States. And the reasons for that are pretty simple. NAFTA destroyed peasant agriculture, because you can't raise corn with a mule and sell it for the same price you can do it in agribusiness in the United States. And it destroyed small industry there because they couldn't compete with American products and Asian products. And so the treaty that was supposed to solve illegal immigration created the largest human migration going on this planet.
So there were enough jobs and family-supporting jobs in peasant agriculture and small industry, Charles?
Well, there were more. They've just been vanished. You know, the shoe industry was destroyed in Mexico. The toy industry was destroyed in Mexico. You know, you can go down a whole list of things. The blanket industry, actually, all their sarapes now come from China. that kind of thing. It had a consequence that our government didn't see coming. President Clinton, Bill Clinton, said that NAFTA would raise the standard of living in Mexico and end illegal immigration. It did exactly the opposite. It is a failed treaty. Then the other factor is the war on drugs. It's now 40 years old. It was really initiated in its current garments under President Nixon. And 40 years later, every illegal drug is more available than it was then, has higher quality than it had then, and has a lower price than it had then in constant dollars. So in 40 years, we've just enhanced distribution of drugs. We tried to repeal a market economy with a law, and after 40 years, it's obvious to me that we failed. As a byproduct, it's kind of like NAFTA. We created the highest per capita prison industry in the country. We created a kind of police state, $30 to $40 billion a year for narcotics enforcement. And now we've got 20,000 agents on the border trying to stop illegal immigration, and we're busy building a wall.
Right.
If this was a business you were running, you'd say, we got to take a meeting. But in fact, our government keeps saying we'll persist in these policies, which, you know, is a sign of an imbecile, as far as I can tell. These are clearly failed policies. Juarez is a place where the price is paid.
Tell me about the addicts who are living. You gave this incredible number of the number of addicts there. How are they helped at all?
Are they? Say that again.
Are they receiving any kind of help? Are there any rehab programs?
No, they interestingly, in the last 3 years, almost all the rehab centers have been machine gunned and people in them killed. Now, one of the scenes in the book is there's a rehab center in the slum, a very poor barrio. And the army pulls up outside, and then guys go inside. In the rehab center, a bunch of people are having a prayer meeting. Yeah. They've just gotten to the altar call, you know, where the minister says, come to the rail, you know, to give yourself to Christ. And for 15 minutes, guys machine gunned everybody.
Why would that happen?
And then they left.
Why?
Well, nobody knows for sure. One of the things you find out in Juarez is you can... If you spend a lot of time, figure out a murder, but the violence has so many sources, it's not easy to figure out. I think, you know, the easiest way to explain it is it was social cleansing. That under the guise of this war against drugs, in fact, the Mexican state is eliminating people it doesn't want. They're disappearing people and on and on. I mean, in Juarez itself, I think in the last 27, 28 months, 5,200 people have been slaughtered. And a bunch more have disappeared. We don't even know what happened to them. But this happens every day. There's been hundreds of complaints against the Army, and I have to tell you, it's almost suicidal to file one. The Mexican official in charge of human rights complaints in Juarez has to live in El Paso because of death threats.
Oh, my goodness.
He's afraid the Army will kill him.
Right.
I know it.
Yeah.
He has to commute to work with bodyguards. You know, This is not the way it's been portrayed either in the American press or by our government. Juarez is supposed to be a success story with 400 factories.
And let's talk a little bit more about the press. You write that the Mexican press has been better in dealing with this issue, but the number of reporters, and there are some poignant stories in your book, who have been murdered for trying to report on this is just sickening.
Well, it's fatal. I mean, it's far more, what I do is, frankly, not as very low risk. To be a reporter in Juarez and try to even get a glimmer of truth in the paper can get you killed. The book's dedicated to Armando Rodriguez, who was slaughtered November 13, 2008, at 8:30 in the morning, sitting in the car in front of his house, warming it up to take his 8-year-old daughter to work. Case has never been solved, but no case is solved in Juarez. So, yeah, they really risk their lives, and their coverage is far more detailed than the U.S. press. The U.S. press visits, talks to a few officials, says it's a cartel war, whatever that means, and then goes away. They never connect anything in the city to its root cause, one, the corruption of the Mexican state, but secondly, mass poverty. It's like a kettle that finally boiled over. And it's not just Juarez. This violence is spreading throughout the country.
Yes.
You know, that's another fantasy, that it's just the border, you know, that it's spreading throughout the nation because something's breaking down there, that things aren't working out the way they planned. Their economy is in deep trouble. Good God, 10%, over 10% of their population now lives in the United States. There's 10 to 15 million Mexicans here living in the shadows, simply as an act of survival. One of the fantasies is, well, they came to the United States because we paid more. Well, we paid more in 1950. You know, this migration is new, and it's because there's no possibility for them anymore in Mexico. It's a migration of the poor is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Charles Bowden is our guest. His book is Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. Our phone number, don't try to get through, our lines are filled, but in a moment you'll be able to get one, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Charles, starting with Rick from Milwaukee. Hi, Rick. Hello, Rick. Are you there?
Hello?
Yes, go right ahead, Rick.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, before I make my comment, just briefly, I want to say that, lest we forget, it was the Clinton administration that put through NAFTA. Ross Perot was entirely right in his predictions on the effect of that. But what I wanted to talk about is the firearms flows in Mexico historically. I just read an article that was printed back in the 1960s about border cops and American police in Texas that used to go on their vacations every year to what they called Old Mexico. And they would go to every hacienda, every ranch, every farm, and they'd buy up all of the military caliber handguns that these Mexican citizens possessed, even though that was all illegal. You know, under the law of Mexico City, they'd come back across the border into Texas with gunny sacks for these military handguns, and they'd sell them at inflated prices in the United States, you know, to gun collectors and whatnot. And they make so much money doing this, they not only paid for their Mexican vacations, but they supplemented their rather meager salaries as Texas cops back in the 60s. And I wonder if your guest had any comment on that.
Well, yeah, I'll make a brief one. That a lot of, you know, guns flow from the United States now into Mexico. But this issue has been exaggerated. Probably 30 or 40, maybe 30% of the guns that have been seized by the Mexican army initiated in the United States, which to me is hardly a matter one way or another, but most of the guns don't come from the United States. So this river of iron that people talk about is a sort of red herring. The second thing is, the Mexican Army's got 250,000 members, and in the last 6 years, 150,000 have deserted. And I think they took their guns with them. And incidentally, U.S. intelligence thinks they deserted to join the drug industry. So whatever's going on in Mexico will not be fixed or created because Americans have the right to buy guns.
So if you're poor living in Juarez, and you're very poor, what are your choices for making a living? Can you still go to one of those 400 factories as a result of NAFTA? Can you eke out a farm living? Do you have to leave? Do you have to become a member of a gang? Do you have to sell drugs? How do you get by?
Okay. The factories are now in a deep recession because we are. Juarez has lost 100,000 jobs in the last 2 years. But if you worked in one of those factories, the most you'd make is $75 a week. And the cost of living in Juarez, I mean, you go to a store and you buy something, is it roughly 90% what it costs to buy something in the United States. So if you're fully employed, and that's 5.5 days a week in one of these factories, you're going to wind up living in a shack with three or four other people who are fully employed, and you'll pool your money and you'll just barely survive. Mm. Now, most of the people don't have that liberty. They can't. They're not even having a job in a maquila. They're living. They're improvising. You know, doing odd jobs or what they call living outside the economy. Now, the final thing is, 50% of the adolescents in Juarez neither in school or have jobs. They're in gangs. There's 500 to 900 gangs.
Unbelievable.
They're improvising a living by killing you, by kidnapping you, by demanding extortion. You have a little stall cart on the street selling tamales. If you don't pay off a gang every week part of your money, they'll put a bullet through your head.
Oh, my goodness.
So, you know, if you look at it, honestly, the people of Juarez are heroic. I cannot tell you how they survive. It's like watching a constant improvisation. A lot of the city has no running water, meaning water's trucked in. A lot of the city really has no electricity. Men climb power lines, steal the power, you know, put on extra wires and run it to their shack, sometimes getting electrocuted. It's a city with very little infrastructure. It's totally corrupt, like most of Mexico, meaning the government is not going to help you. But Mexicans don't report crimes because they know the police will just come and rob them. And there's no convictions. I'll give you a statistic. There were 2,753 murders officially in the city last year. There were 30 arrests for homicide. Not convictions. Arrests. You know?
Wow.
Now, after splattering all these numbers on your listeners' ears, you have to imagine what kind of a durable person it takes to maintain a family, maintain a life there. That's what I mean. There's something heroic about these people because they have no help. You know, they're soldiering on because they have no choice.
Right.
They don't have the money to get to the United States, and there's no work in Mexico, so they're trapped.
Thank you, Rick, for the call. We go to another Rick from Fond du Lac. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. Interesting topic. I travel to Juarez often for business. I may own a transportation and logistics company, and obviously your guest knows with the maquilas how prevalent that business is linked to that back and forth. So I'm there often. The thing that I hear from a lot of business leaders and some of the leaders I speak to are, one of them is actually the president of the Maquiladora Association in Chihuahua, and I know him well. And a lot of people believe that once Calderon is out, that they get a new president in, and he starts the so-called play ball with the cartel and shove it under the rug, the violence will be reduced. Now, that's one comment. I want to get your opinion of that. That's sort of the underlying current theme that I hear. The second one is, I mean, how much, if the United States would legalize, or decriminalize marijuana. And I'm just wondering if you have any numbers on the kinds of drugs coming in. From what everything I hear, most of the talk I hear is about marijuana when I'm down there. The other thing is it's interesting because I traveled to Nuevo Laredo and the crime was bad there about a couple of years back. And it sort of has moved from there to Juarez. And now there's a new border town in Santa Teresa being developed with a large organization from China called Foxconn, which I'm familiar with. But so I'm in there and traveling for business, and I'm wondering if it's true what people are telling me with Calderon not putting so much pressure on that some of this drug wars will subside a little bit, and it'll just sort of have an underlying current of corruption that it'll be easier to deal with. That's what people who live there say. What do you think of that?
I think it's a pipe dream. They tell that to me, too. But what they're fantasizing is that somebody can actually be in control of the country. I think the genie has gotten out of the bottle in the last 3 years, and you can't put it back in. I think there's been a life experience, an explosion of people living by violence now, and they're not going to go away. So I think it's fair to say that Calderon's initiative was the match in the powder room that blew the situation up, but I don't think you can undo it. The other thing you got to realize is the enormous amount of drugs consumed now in Mexico, which nobody wants to mention. I know in February of 2008, I was sitting down with the leader of one of the gangs, and I asked him how much it would cost me to get a fix of heroin. And he said $2.50. Now, there are drugs all over Juarez, meaning in the poorest barrio, you can buy drugs everywhere, cocaine, heroin, marijuana. The people working in the maquilas now are buying lots of drugs because they're dirt cheap, and that isn't going to go away. But the consequence of that is, many of your listeners probably know from watching the HBO series The Wire, is once you get a drug culture, a consumption at that level, and it's illegal, every street corner becomes worth killing over. meaning every little local venue. And a lot of the killing going on in Juarez now is between little gangs fighting over street corners. It isn't cartels. If you look at it logically, the cartels never care who's on the street corner. They're wholesalers. You got to go buy from them anyway. So I don't think you can unring the bell to go back. I mean, it's a fair question. See, the business class in Mexico has always been protected. They had kind of immunity because they had money. Now they don't have that. They're in danger. And so what I think is they think back to the days when they were safe and say, well, if we just get rid of this president, get a president that cuts a deal with these fabled cartels, life will return to normal. I think it's too late.
Thank you, Rick, very much for the call. Is there some, I know you were sitting outside, or you were probably in it too at some point, this new church that was funded by drug money. Are there parts of Juarez that are kind of fancy because of drug money?
Yes. There's rich districts, but they've been largely abandoned. Those are the people that have moved to El Paso across the river. But yes, most of the high-end restaurants in Juarez are now in El Paso because everybody's too afraid to go out at night. So, but there's narco money. I've always wanted to do a book on these sort of drug houses in Juarez because it's a style. It's narcotecture. You can just pick out, you'll drive in, you'll see a new house, and you know somebody's in the life because of the peculiar way it's designed. And they're kind of moving. They're a folk art by the Mexican poor, meaning people with very little education that suddenly get a couple million bucks because they're successful in the drug world and build these sort of Moorish palaces with domes everywhere. They're kind of touching, you know. They're the anti-Bauhaus and modernist thesis.
Oh, my goodness.
And there's areas of the city that are just solid drug people. One of the people in the book, the late Esther Chavez Cano, who founded the first women's shelter in Juarez, which I must say treats 30,000 women a year now for abuse and rape. She lived on a cul-de-sac, and one time I was there for lunch, and she pointed out that every house on her cul-de-sac except hers were people in the drug business.
Every house.
It was a fairly nice neighborhood. We would think of it as middle class, but it was, you know, quite nice. And they were all just these little palaces with domes. They were all drug people.
Wow.
Now, when you think of that, I mean, everybody knows who these people are. It's preposterous to think the Mexican army is, quote, attacking the drug industry. Because all these people just go on living in their little narco mansion.
Yeah. Here's an email that's come in from Rebecca. First of all, she says you are fascinating, and you are. When I just heard your guest say that there were 400 foreign-owned companies who are making the situation worse, she wonders, can we get a list of these companies? They should be, and I wonder if you agree with this, pressured to change by writing them or making it public who they are and we as consumers of their products, what we are contributing to.
Well, I'll agree with the listener halfway. Meaning, I'm appalled at the pay scale in these factories, but you can't ask a company to reform itself. It has to reform itself in a market. I think we should rewrite NAFTA. NAFTA has no protections for the environment that are of enforced. It has no protections for unions, and it has essentially no protection for workers. That I am tired of walking into the Walmarts in my country and finding every product essentially made by slaves in foreign plants. That I think if we're going to have trade, and I believe in trade, that we have to write into these treaties that people have to get a living wage. And a living wage isn't a mystical thing. You pay a person enough every day so they can live on it, have shelter, water, electricity, etc. We're not doing that. I defy anybody listening here to go to Juarez and I'll give them $75 and say, here, you've just earned your week's wages. Now go live for a week. They're not going to have a happy time. It's not a cheap city. So what I think is we should talk to our congressman. This treaty isn't working. It is not benefiting the Mexican people. Do you think 10 to 15 million Mexicans fled here because things were so good down there after NAFTA? And it's not benefiting the American people. It's not benefiting us morally, buying products made by slaves. And it's certainly not benefiting us to have factories shut down in our own cities and go there, and then people get the same jobs and have miserable wages.
Mm-hmm.
And there's books on that. William J. Adler, I think it is, or M. Adler, wrote Molly's Job, tracing one job from New Jersey to Mexico and writing parallel lives of the woman that had the job in New Jersey for 20-odd years and the woman who got the job in Mexico. And it's well worth your listeners' time.
Josh from Milwaukee. Hi, Josh.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. My question is, I have a family member that's moving to El Paso. He's in the military.
Yes.
And he's got a newborn and a wife, and I'm just wondering what the impact of the violence is in Juarez on the city of El Paso. I'll take my comments off the air.
Essentially zero. You know, U.S. agencies keep talking about violence spilling across the border. It's functionally a lie. I'll give you a statistic. 2,753 murders in Juarez last year. I think two or three, or maybe it was 10 in El Paso. So they're roughly the same size, the cities. El Paso has one of the lowest crime rates in the country. So don't worry. That's not a problem.
Tell me again about the number of people in government who are actually working from El Paso.
Oh, the person I met is the human rights representative is now living in El Paso. I'll give you a couple other facts. You know, nobody knows, but their guess is between 30 and 60,000, you know, affluent, well-off Mexicans who moved to El Paso in the last 2 years, bought houses, started businesses because the violence is too great in Juarez. But what's happening now is the cartel members are moving to El Paso.
Oh.
And they're moving to El Paso because it's too dangerous to live in Juarez. Look, I'm not making this up. I won't tell you how I know this. We'll just say I just know people in the business. They're colonizing parts of El Paso, but they're good citizens. They're commuting to work in Juarez every day and doing their killing there or whatever you do in the drug business. And then coming home to El Paso at night because it's safe for them and their families.
And having dinner with a human rights representative?
Yeah, quite possibly.
Right.
One of the things you learn on the border is you eventually get to know people in all kinds of walks of life. It's not the darkness. It's the edge of town. It's woven into the fabric of these communities. Everybody with a good-sized family on the border has some family member that's dabbling in the business, let us say. Hmm. That's not how you decide who's honest or crooked, you know. But yes. I mean, look at it. 15 years ago, the banks in El Paso had $750 million a year in deposits that couldn't be possibly explained by the local economy. It was all drug money. That's DEA statistic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been going on a long time. But El Paso is, well, it's one of the safest cities in the country. It has one of the lowest crime rates.
Brian from Sheboygan, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I realize this is really multi-layered, the situation down there, but I'm wondering if the guests would comment on American responsibility. People are using recreational drugs here, and that effect on people down there. I mean, tie it to the blood here. There's a huge amount of violence down there. You say there's lots of Mexicans using the drugs, but certainly I would think Americans bear a big responsibility, and it's very directly related to that violence.
Okay, I'll be happy to comment on that. Like Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has linked drug consumption here, meaning drug users, to deaths in Mexico. And you can make that argument, but I think you're missing the real point. The reason people are dying in Mexico is because of the American war on drugs. The reason that people are dying in Mexico is because of drug prohibition in this country. But after 40 years, we haven't really cut drug consumption. The industry is bigger than ever. And that's what's causing the death. I mean, drugs are junk. You know, they're easy to produce. There would not be the violence. There would not be the money in them if they were legal. The second thing is, after 40 years, we've proven absolutely that a government policy can't stop American citizens from using drugs. I travel a lot in this country because I'm a freelance writer. And the drugs are everywhere. They're especially rural America seems to be saturated with them. And so I think it's time to smell the coffee. We're pursuing a policy that kills people in Mexico, incarcerates people in the United States, and doesn't work.
Thanks for the call. Here's an email, touching one, and your book is filled with these stories from John, who just read this. 4 dead after kidnapping at wedding in Juarez. He says, I just saw this article. These people were murdered yesterday from a wedding party.
Well, torture, too. That incident is true. There was a wedding, I think, Saturday or Sunday. A bunch of armed guys showed up, told everybody to get on the floor, left, I think, with the groom and some members of his family. Three or four, it took three guys with them, killed one there. And then a day later, they found the bodies wrapped, the heads wrapped with duct tape, tortured, etc. Now, you got to understand, I have a friend there who's a minister in Juarez. He's in the book, Pastor Galvan.
Right.
And every day he has to drive across the city to get to a mental institution he runs, and he goes through seven checkpoints. But apparently this truckload of killers with a bunch of people they'd kidnapped were invisible to all these checkpoints. What I'm saying is whatever happened was sanctioned. It's a joke that the army and the police are trying to stop the violence. They're not. Now, two of the people killed were U.S. citizens. They lived in New Mexico. They'd come down for a family wedding. Why they were targeted, why they were killed, I don't know. But this goes on every day.
And you never find out, right? Because there aren't any investigations done. So there are all these deaths and nobody knows why.
January 31st, well, nothing happens. January 31st, a high school down there, and you have to pay to go to high school. It's a privilege, not a right. The kids had a soccer victory, and they wanted to celebrate, and the parents, this was in a working-class barrio, not rich. The parents said, no, it's too dangerous. You have to hold it here in the house. And so a bunch of these kids had a party in a little house in the barrio. And then carloads of killers arrived and executed 15 of them. And then drove away. And the police didn't come for half an hour, 45 minutes, or the army. Now, these were just kids. These were straight kids. Their parents, this is real bootstrap, their parents were sacrificing everything to pay for them to go to high school. And they were boys and girls together. They slaughtered them all. But that was a breaking point for the city. Like, this is hopeless. You know, we do everything right. The president of Mexico was in Tokyo at the time, and because he apparently has a third eye, he instantly announced that the kids that were killed were all dirty, which caused an unbelievable revolt in the parents. He then flew to Mexico, to Juarez, to try and put out the fire of his ill-timed remark. And one of the mothers of two of the dead boys stood up in a meeting, which is unheard of there, to speak to the president of Mexico. He's like God. And she said, you're not welcome here. We don't want you here. My sons weren't dirty. She said, you know, if your son were killed, you'd turn over every stone in this country for justice. And now you're doing nothing. And then she turned her back on him. It galvanized the whole country, that moment. Because she spoke what everybody knew, that they're dying. Whatever the president's doing with his, quote, war, it's just getting them killed. And they want it ended.
Charles Bowden is our guest. His book is Murder City, Ciudad Juarez, and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. Well, we'll go to more phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls. Janice from La Crosse. Hi.
Yeah, hi. This is rather upsetting with a lot of the things I'm hearing, but definitely not for drugs. I mean, legalizing them, no. I mean, I feel sorry for Juarez. I mean, hello, what a tough place to want to be. And I don't blame the Mexicans or want to get the heck out of there. But we still have to have these borders. To me, if you're legally here, no problem. Just be here legally. You know, that's not a problem. But we cannot have this illegalness going on here. And I want to know what's going on with the Mexican government. What are they doing to help, you know, dispel this problem in Juarez? I mean, what are they doing? You know, all we U.S. that we have to solve everybody's problem. You know, what's the Mexicans doing about that? What's their government doing about Juarez and the problems of drugs down there?
Okay, I'll be happy to answer that. Functionally, the Mexican government does nothing. It's totally corrupt. And I certainly understand why American citizens don't want people here illegally. But I don't think we have a choice anymore. That Mexico, they're already here. So are the drugs. that we have a country breaking down on our border and that people are going to continue to come. The wall isn't going to stop them. Nothing's going to stop them. This is not a simple solution. The second thing that I think I'd tell the listener is the Mexican government wants these people to come. You take a guy or a woman deep in Mexico who is making maybe $4 or $5 a day, and that person goes to Chicago and starts working in a back room washing dishes, and suddenly he's sending money home.
Right.
It's like an ATM machine. That is what's happening. That $20 to $25 billion a year that illegal workers are sending home to Mexico.
Wow.
Is not chump change. That's a lifeline to the country. So what you should, you know, we're going to have a discussion of this, and I think it's long overdue in our society. The Mexican government is exporting human beings as one of their products. They can't feed them. If they send them here, they help feed other Mexicans. But the xenophobia, I'm from Arizona. The growing resentment of this migration, I fully understand. I've watched people change, you know, their attitudes. But it doesn't change what's driving the migration, which is a collapse of Mexico. One last thought is, you know, to ask a Mexican to enter here legally is to tell him to go down to an office and get a number and stand in line, and he'll be there 75 to 100 years. There essentially is no way for the average poor Mexican to come here legally, and so they come here illegally.
And put the order of importance in terms of keeping the Mexican economy going as much as it does go. Is it number one, oil? Number two, Mexicans in this country sending back that $25 billion? Number three, drugs? Or?
No, it's oil, then the remittances, and then tourism.
And then tourism.
Then nobody ever mentions drugs, but it dwarfs number two and three, and probably now equals oil.
Really?
Yes. You know, so one other thing, if you think we have problems now, I'll toss this grenade out there. By the estimates of the Mexican government, their oil fields, which produce 40% of all revenue for the federal government in Mexico, will be exhausted in 9 years.
Uh-oh.
So don't think drugs are going to go away. That drugs are essential to Mexico. What you're hearing is a bunch of piety from our government and their government. That they can't exterminate drugs. The whole thing collapses like a house of cards. Any more than the Mexican government can stop exporting people. It's not simply they get rid of somebody they have to feed. The person they export becomes a revenue stream. So you take Mexican states like Zacatecas, which is a pretty good-sized state, 50% of its population now lives in the United States. This is widespread around the country. As I said earlier in this program, this is the largest movement, migration, going on this planet, the movement of the Mexican poor to the United States. Now, I'm kind of a cranky guy. I mean, I'm kind of an environmentalist. I'd like to take us back to the Pleistocene. When I was born, there were about 140 million Americans, and it seemed a little crowded then. Now there's 300 million. But having said that, that changes nothing. You know, we cannot wall off reality. Reality is this breakdown, and we're going to have to deal with it. And part of dealing with it is we're going to have a lot more Mexicans here. Mm-hmm. It isn't you don't functionally have a choice. All these Mexicans are illegal now, and they're here. You know, it's like people say we can't legalize drugs. They'll be in the neighborhood. I always tell them the same thing. Maybe you should take a walk around the block. That the drugs are everywhere now, all we've done is determine two things. People that consume them are at risk of going to prison. And secondly, we're going to give a bunch of money to killers that move the drugs here. I don't consider that a very sound way to go about it.
Yeah. Thanks, Janice, for the call. Rick from Eau Claire, I hear that these treaties and policies, NAFTA, the war on drugs, et cetera, are not failed. They're hugely successful in achieving the intent of the corporations and cartels that invented them. Enormous profits for multinationals, along with an enormous pool of slave labor, workers who may be declared illegal the moment that they complain. Juarez is indeed the city of the future.
Well, you know, part of that comment I agree with. I don't think the cartels invented our drug laws. In fact, there's a very good book on that by Dan Baum called Smoke and Mirrors. The These draconian laws came into existence every time an American politician got in trouble. You could always run against phantom drug problems. But the slave factory thing, yes, that's benefited American corporations. But I just don't see the benefit to my people, the American people, or to my friends, the Mexican people, by destroying a job in Ohio and then sending it to some place in Mexico where it pays wages people can't live on. I mean, we have to do a little better than that.
Susan from Racine, hi.
Hi. I've been listening to the program. Thank you for allowing me to talk. I lived in Albuquerque for a number of years, 25 years, and just in that time frame, I saw so many people desperately try to get out of their own country, which is the country we know of milk and honey. Why? That's what we have to ask ourselves. Another thing I want to just bring up quickly is, why don't we just annex Mexico to the United States? And in Arizona, if we do not educate these people, all we're breeding is contempt.
Well, I have a friend, Phil Caputo, the novelist. His solution was we just, you know, annex Mexico because we can defend the isthmus easier. But in fact, that's not an option. You know, it's not like we get to make the decision. Mexico's a sovereign nation, one that has deep grievances against our country, which we seem oblivious to. I mean, they lost half their country in the Mexican War, and they remember that. The best thing we can do is look at our policies and determine which policies are making Mexico worse. I think NAFTA, the free trade agreement, is. I think the war on drugs is. And I think our current policy, called Plan Merida, which gives $500 million a year to the Mexican army, is insane, because the Mexican army is essentially a criminal organization. So I think we should, you know, like a doctor, adopt policies that at least don't make the patient worse. But I don't have a quick fix for Mexico anymore than I have a quick fix for the American economy. I'm simply saying we need to look at things a little more factually than we have instead of rhetoric. Like, I'm fully aware, I'm fully sympathetic, as I said earlier, to people being annoyed by an illegal immigration into the United States. I've certainly been with enough Minutemen and written stories. But when you get finished expressing your discontent with this, it doesn't change the migration, because these people can't stay there. But look, we've just spent a fortune on a wall along the border, and it doesn't mean a damn thing. I'll give you an anecdote. They built a wall across a section of Arizona called the Altar Valley. And within days of finishing the wall, there was a huge gate cut in the wall with plasma torches by Mexicans, and they put the hinges on the Mexican side.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, this isn't going to solve it. We'll never solve it until, through our policies and through Mexican policies, there's a Mexico that people don't want to flee.
Right, right.
Anything else is just, you know, rhetoric for a political rally. It isn't going to change anything.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to Eric next from Madison. Hi, Eric.
Hi. My question is, my wife, I just got married to a Mexican citizen in Mexico, and we are currently going through all the paperwork and immigration nonsense to get her here. The eventual outcome is she's going to be issued an interview for the visa she needs to come here, and the only embassy, American embassy that does it, their consulate, is in Juarez.
Yeah, it's the biggest consulate in the world.
Yeah, so I'm kind of torn on what to do. I guess we were going to have to go there, but I just...
Well, I'm not a lawyer, but yes, you'll have to go there. And you probably won't have any problem. But certainly... Well, you know, they just killed three people that were affiliated with the consulate back in March.
Yes.
I can't guarantee safety in Juarez, but that is, this huge consulate is where everybody has to go. But, you know, trying to make your trip easier, just go to El Paso and then walk across the bridge and take a cab to the consulate and then take a cab back to the bridge.
Oh, is that helpful, Eric? There, yeah, that's good.
I mean, she wouldn't be able to do that, though. I mean, technically, I don't have to go, but I don't want to send her to Juarez by herself. She lives in the south of Mexico, and she's also terrified.
No, I understand. It's a lawless city. To the extent you could say Mexico is lawless, this is like the distillate of it. I don't have a magical solution. I'm just saying that a lot of people have to go through this, and it's not pleasant.
Right.
Doesn't mean anything's going to happen, but good heavens, there's a Denny's right next to the consulate, and they executed a bunch of they executed people inside the Denny's in broad daylight.
Make your trip as quick as possible. We're out of time, Charles. Thank you so much for being with us. This is a hard issue. Thank you. Charles Bowden, our guest. His book is Murderer City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. He has spent a number of years, about 15 years, looking at this city in its, well, it's quite an account, as you can tell from listening to this interview. He is the author of many books, Down by the River, A Shadow in the City, Some of the Dead Are Still Breathing, and a contributing editor for Mother Jones, Gentleman Quarterly, and other publications. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour. Thanks, everybody, for your calls. We'll be with you again tomorrow on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.